This is What's Next from American Security Project. I'm Maggie Feldman-Pilch. Today I'm joined by Lieutenant General Jim Dubik, retired from the Army. General Dubik is a senior fellow at the Institute of Land Warfare and the Institute for the Study of War, a professor and director of teaching at Georgetown's Security Studies Program in the Center for Security, and author of the recently published Just War Revisited. General Dubik, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Maggie. Glad to be here.
So, General Dubik, I think most people outside of the Army and the Armed Forces perhaps know you from your final post on active duty in Baghdad, working to build and enlarge the Iraqi police and military. But you're also a well-known and respected ethicist. But that's not what we're talking about today. Today we're talking about what you call the pre-something period. What is the pre-something period?
Well, if I knew, I wouldn't call it the pre-something. But the point I wanted to make is that we are no longer in the post-Cold War period. And I believe that because there are several things that have happened that lead me to conclude that we're building towards something else. What that is will depend on how things work out. And my belief came from looking at how much we focused on the post-9/11 wars, which we must do. I don't have any problem with that. But there are other things that are going on that suggest that the post-9/11 war is itself part of a larger set of patterns. So I start with the post-Cold War period. Mm-hmm. Actually, I start with the Cold War period, which was built upon World War II and the security environment put in place by our predecessors after World War II. That security system has been very beneficial to a large number of countries. Of course, the United States, primary among them, our allies in Europe, our allies in the Pacific. And that has, with some nuclear deterrence and the strength of American conventional deterrent capacity, has kept the peace for 60-plus years. What I see, though, going on now are threats to that very peace, threat to that very security environment put in place 1945-plus. The first set of threats come from revisionist powers. I call those Russia, China, and Iran. The revisionist powers are not interested in dumping the international system. They just want it revised so that they gain more than we do, and that the system plays to their benefit. The second set of powers, Al-Qaeda and ISIS, are what I call revolutionary powers. And this may seem like kind of an odd name because many people just put them in the category of terrorists, but I don't. Terrorism is the means that they are using, among others, to depose nations, which they have tried in Iraq. They are darn near have done it in Syria.
Yeah.
They're trying again in Afghanistan. They tried in Libya. They're trying in Mali. And so these are revolutionaries who are using force to depose states and impose their version of Islamic fundamentalism, a version, I might add, that is abhorrent to most Muslims.
Right.
So you have these revolutionary powers and revisionist powers both vying and gnawing at the international system that was put in place. I call this the pre-something period because depending on how well we and our allies do in this competition with both revisionists and revolutionaries and how we keep at bay, well, what I call the rogue power, the North Korea, how well we do will determine what the next period is. If we use our power well, our influence well, and I don't mean just military, I mean economic and diplomatic, we may structure an international system, improve what and update what we had in place after World War II, and see a period of peace for another 50 years. If, however, we don't, if we continue to prolong the war with the revolutionary powers to no real strategic end, which is what we have been doing for 15 years, and we allow the revisionist powers to carve out spheres of influence, then we'll be in a very different security situation.
So it sounds like from what you're saying and from what your recent essay in Army Magazine gets at is that we're really kind of at a crossroads. And this pre-something period that doesn't quite have a name yet other than pre-something is happening regardless or maybe even perhaps because of other things going on in the world. We have a new president-elect. There are a lot of changes in terms of the global leadership, and I wonder how you see those changes kind of fitting into this idea of the pre-something period.
Well, actually, I think, Maggie, those are exactly right, but there's also some longer-term trends. We have been, for example, in the emergence of the information age for about 50 years. You can draw it however you want, maybe 1950, let's use that, that's an easy number. So for 60-plus years, we've been emerging into an information age. Well, this is a significant set of trends because the information age is replacing the industrial age. The industrial age took 200 years, maybe 150, to replace the agrarian age. And in that time, World War II, World War I, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, revolutions took place during the last time the information or the industrial age took place, took over the agrarian. There were a whole bunch of wars, whole bunch of revolutions, and in 1950, the world looked significantly different than it did in 1760. People lived differently. They were governed differently. The economies run differently. You made money differently. Religions changed significantly. We're going through that shift right now. And part of this pre-something period that I'm calling is the result of this shift. And we should be prepared to operate in this kind of strategic ambiguity for a good number of years. The last time it happened, it was not a peaceful period. And I don't expect this to be a peaceful period. So how we resolve the Revolutionary Wars, how we negotiate and resolve the pressures from the revisionist powers will very much impact how the world unfolds in the next 50 to 100 years.
And do you think there are particular lessons from maybe the post-Cold War, or even post-World War II era, that can help us build a path of how to resolve those revolutionary wars for a pre-something period?
Yeah, I do. I think there's at least three. First, I think the nuclear deterrence, which has kept the war below the threshold of nuclear deterrence, is very important. And America's capacity in the nuclear deterrence role must be upgraded and maintained. We can't risk that. Second, in the same vein, we should prevent the revolutionary powers, of course, from attaining any semblance of a nuclear order, of a nuclear capacity, dirty or clean. Mm-hmm. And then third, we should really upgrade the conventions that prevent the proliferation of nuclear weapons. So that's the first category. Second is conventional power. The reason that people are operating in what's now called the gray zone. Other people have called it hybrid warfare, three-block war.
Whatever you want.
Yeah, whatever the name is du jour.
Yeah.
The reason it's below the threshold of war is because no one wants to take on the United States and its allies conventionally. Mm. Well, the more we erode that capacity, which I must say has eroded to a degree that I think should concern us all. Mm. I'm not saying we're now a weak power.
Right.
We're not. But the erosion has been going on for 10 years, maybe 12 years, and we need to reverse this because should the competitors view the threshold of war no longer something they fear to cross, then it's merely a conceptual line and it will be crossed. So attending to Americans and its allies' conventional strength is as important as is the nuclear deterrence. And then the third part, I think, is strengthening our alliances. The kinds of problems we're facing now and the kinds of problems we'll face for the rest of the time the information age emerges will be problems no one nation can solve by itself. So we first, I think, have to be very attentive to our close allies and then reach out and build either bilateral or multilateral relationships with other countries. Our relationship in the Middle East, for example, is very important, yet it's probably at its worst than it's been in a good number of years. This is the third leg, I think, of solidifying a base to go forward with an increased probability of peaceful resolution of competition rather than violent resolution.
And all three of these areas, I don't want to say that they're policy and not politics, because, of course, politics plays into policy, but in a way that is sort of what you're saying. These are issues that have really nothing to do, in a sense, with politics, how we think of them in the United States, kind of domestic politics.
Well, I would differ just a little bit, because policy is a reflection of the international system and domestic politics. And I think it's pretty well agreed that the politics for a good number of years, where you want to put the pin to start this, you know, is up to you, but a good number of years, the politics in the United States has become more and more divisive and more stark choices between either the extreme on the right or the extreme on the left. And as a result of this, the bipartisan agreement on international and foreign policy and the bipartisan agreement on security policies is itself eroding and fraying. And I would say that with good evidence, you could trace back to at least the first Clinton administration and say that we no longer had a foreign policy with which both sides of the aisle agreed.
Sure.
Clinton put in place a policy that was, quote unquote, not Bush. And then the president following Clinton put in a policy that is, quote unquote, not Clinton, and so on.
Sure.
So we've been defining our foreign policy and our security policy as not the previous guy, rather than forming the policy as a cohesive whole agreed to by both sides of the aisle.
And how do you think we get back to, you know, something that quite frankly has not existed since I've been alive, of this consensus? Or are we too far gone?
Well, I guess I'm an optimist in all things, sometimes erroneously so, but I think this is a function of political leadership and political will. And the voice of bipartisanship has not grown strong enough and has not gone enough, it hasn't been present enough in our political discussions. We should at least agree on, from both sides of the aisle, on achieving bipartisanship in the national security and foreign policy area. The domestic policies can maybe follow, maybe not, but for sure we should strive a heck of a lot harder, and I hope this administration does this, to get agreement and a solid foundation on where we want the United States to lead, why, from both sides of the aisle.
You know, and I hesitate to say what would it look like to you, because I almost know better that what the answer to that question would be. But, you know, what do you think it would look like for, what should we be striving for, I guess?
Well, if I could use an analogy, prior to World War II, the President Roosevelt and Prime Minister Churchill agreed to the Atlantic Charter. And the Atlantic Charter was a document that cemented the two leaders into a vision of the kind of world they wanted to see emerge after World War II. Now, this document was put in place and agreed to when things looked pretty bad, when World War II was not a sure thing. It wasn't a sure thing till maybe 1943, but even then you could argue not. But the two world leaders and then saw in a positive way what they wanted to use war for. And that's the kind of thing that we need, not take the Atlantic Charter and resurrect it. This is not 1941. It's 2016. So some kind of vision, a positive vision of the kind of world that we want to create by succeeding in the struggle against the revolutionary powers and resolving the conflict with the revisionist powers. So we have some positive aim to go for. Right now, our strategic aims are, in my view, narrow and military. Defeat Al-Qaeda, or defeat, dismantle, and disrupt Al-Qaeda, and defeat ISIS. These are great objectives for a military campaign, but they're not a positive agenda, a strategic agenda that lays out what kind of world we want to create. 1945, the world looked like it did. 2016 doesn't look like that. Mm-hmm. And so the kind of structures that our predecessors were prescient enough to put in place have to be upgraded, have to be changed, have to adapt to the information age that's unfolding, and have to recognize that in this information age, there are winners and losers. And to try to create structures that the losers don't see as it's a zero-sum game for them, that a better future for them is in the never-happen category, that they have some stake in the international system. These are the kinds of things that a real alliance would create. And my view, we've been working for the past 15 years with coalitions that are more like posses of the Wild West, where you get a bunch of people who are willing to jump on your and ride with you. They buy in only to the degree that they are willing to do, but they have no say or little say.
Right.
Like the sheriff. The sheriff says, this is what we're going to do. You with me or you're not. That has been more dominant, I think, unfortunately, in the last 15 years than gathering up a close-knit set of allies, starting with the nations of NATO and extending that to some in the Middle East. Turkey, for example, is already in NATO and a key player in the Middle East, and say, as an alliance, what kind of world do we want to create in the Middle East and in Europe, and then with our Pacific allies there too, and use that as the basis to move forward.
When you look out at kind of the global landscape now, is there a particular, not just an alliance, but is there something out there that is kind of a shining glimmer of hope that says to you, in the pre-something age, you know, there is real, almost tangible hope that we can build that?
Yeah, I count NATO to be that that shining hope. It has the U.S. relationship with other NATO countries, because the U.S. is a NATO country.
That's right, yeah.
The relationship among nations has kind of gone down a little bit. Some part, the reason is economics. Another part is attention. That when you call the nations of Europe, old Europe, and pretend as if they don't matter, this has an effect. When your key nations of your allies tell us not to do something like invade Iraq, and you do it anyway, this has an effect on a relationship. So I think that there's time, the time is to rebuild that relationship in a very real way, make the NATO relation a defensive alliance, not just a defensive alliance against conventional nuclear war, but a conventional alliance against revolutionary powers. That basis could provide a solid foundation for the next step, which would be extend not NATO, but another alliance or a set of bilateral relationships with one or more Middle East countries that also would buy into the future that we envision. And then you start expanding the legitimacy of the actions that you have to take to destroy the revolutionary powers, and you start demonstrating to the revisionist powers that there's a pretty strong community of nations that will react negatively under some circumstances, but are inclusive in other circumstances. So you can use the power of the alliance both for security purposes, military purposes, and for diplomatic purposes.
And do you see any real possibility of the revolutionary powers and the revisionist powers renaming themselves and becoming some sort of, you know, I don't want to say axis of evil, but let's say axis of evil for lack of a better term?
I don't. The revolutionary powers are on their own line, and it's written into their documents that they have produced in the early 90s. So I don't view them anything more than what they are. as fantastic as we may think it is, they do have a kind of country, regional, world domination view of things.
Right.
And we shouldn't laugh that off, because
right.
they have been on that line since the mid-1990s. They're taking steps to achieve their strategic aim. And if you can envision a map, for example, in 2000, the number of dots that represented where Al-Qaeda was were maybe 3, 2.
Mm.
Number of dots for ISIS, 0. And now you go to shift that map to 2016. You know, there's reason for these two guys to think that, hey, they're working out, their strategy is starting to unfold. So I don't see an axis of evil for them. I also don't believe that China, Russia, and Iran are in cahoots in some specter-like
right.
organization.
Contrary to many conspiracy
yeah.
theories.
Yeah. I think that these are actually reasonable demands, that some are reasonable demands that the international system should be adjusted. And in those cases where we think it should, we ought to work together toward this. And in those cases where their reasonable demands are really not reasonable, but rather demands that would prevent the kind of international system that would be beneficial, then we ought to have the power of an alliance in Europe and in the Pacific to use as the basis for collective action.
So, General Dubik, our final question is always, what's next? And if it's okay with you, I'd like to break it maybe into two parts. So, what do you think the world will look like in this pre-something period 15 years, 20 years from now, should we do it right or wrong? And in the next 4 years, as we look at a new administration, what do you think are some key ways that, recognizing this is a whole-of-government operation, but at least with a new head of government that can help turn the rest of it, could put us on the path or not?
Well, I'll start with the 4 years. I think that the Trump administration will face some very turbulent times and have some significant challenges pushed its way to test the president himself and to determine the strength of will in the United States. I think that the revisionist powers especially, revolutionary powers also, but the revisionist powers have pushed the envelope for the last 10 years, both the Obama and part of the Bush administration, as far as they think they can below the threshold of triggering international intervention. I think they're going to press this administration to see how far those limits are for them. And how we respond will determine whether or not that threshold has changed. There are a number of people who believe, I'm not one among them, who say that the operations short of war, these gray zone operations, operations below the threshold of war, is all our future contains.
Hmm.
Well, maybe, but that depends on how we react to these crises. So I think in the next 4 years we should be set for some crises, and I think the conventional power of the American Armed Forces should receive some attention, because I think it's not where it should be right now. So the 15 years outlook depends on how well we do in,
sure.
in these 4 years. If we do well, then we may keep our competition below the threshold of war, and that's good, and we may be able to start shrinking the expansion of the revolutionary powers. If we respond poorly and continue our war against revolutionary powers, prolonging an already long war unnecessarily, not achieving many strategic aims, just kind of muddling along, and we respond poorly to the revisionist powers, then I think there's a possibility that in 15 or 20 years, you will see two or three spheres of influence
mm-hmm.
that are much more competitive than the kind of global international environment our predecessors put in place in 1945. And a hyper-competitive environment in spheres of influence generally don't turn out peacefully.
Right. Well, General Dubik, thank you for joining us.
Maggie, thanks for the questions. Thanks for the opportunity. Appreciate it.
We will absolutely have you back if you'll come back.
We will.
This has been What's Next from American Security Project. I'm Maggie Milton-Filch.